5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, welcome to News Roast. My name is Aidan Prowse.
And I'm Julian Rubenstein.
And this is a podcast where we sit down for an hour and a half with people that we wish we could have over for dinner. So we created an excuse to get them round a table, which is the podcast.
It's literally three courses of conversation.
Yes.
This is the sort of podcast where if you're on a first date or, you know, you're going to an interesting interview for a job, you can hopefully seem a bit more intelligent than you are by tit-picking.
Tit-picking?
Tit-picking.
Tit-picking.
Yeah, that's yeah. Hopefully not that.
Yeah.
Tit-picking.
What is tit-picking?
That would literally be picking tits, wouldn't it? In a rather sort of Roald Dahl twits kind of.
We're not going to be.
This is not what that is.
We're not going to be ticking John Lloyd's. Tipping John Lloyd's.
Once again,
are we?
I hope not. I mean, maybe he'll be into that. I don't know. We'll see. But this is the sort of podcast where we are always very honoured to be joined by a guest who's far more intelligent than us.
Yes.
And we can sort of hopefully like a kind of parasite sort of like draw information out of them to make ourselves look more intelligent. And by proxy, the audience.
Exactly. The idea for this podcast came about when Julian said to me, how can we get more ideas to make us seem funnier and smarter? And I said, well, how about we do a podcast where we invite funny and smart people and then we just talk to them for an hour and a half and steal all their ideas.
Brilliant.
And you were like, great.
Amazing.
And then Terry came in and said he'd produce it.
Yes. That's amazing.
And then we get people like John Lloyd along so we can steal all his
jokes. How was your week? Your week was all right?
My week was fine, yeah.
Yeah? Pretty good?
Pretty good, thanks. Yeah,
good.
Yeah,
good.
How about yours?
Well, yeah, it's been all right actually. I mean, this is our sort of
seen you every
third
day.
Go at the podcast, isn't it? We had a fantastic first episode with Josie, and then Ramesh came along and made us realise how unfunny we are.
And I think this is our most heavyweight,
highbrow
guest.
We're on Titans now.
Would you like to introduce our guest?
It would be my pleasure. We are absolutely honoured to be joined by John Lloyd. CBE, no less.
What?
The man behind such comedy behemoths as Spitting Image, Not the 9 o'clock News, and most recently QI. The man who produced four series, I believe,
Blackadder.
And
pretty much every decent piece of comedy, standout decent piece of comedy over the last 20 years.
And also a bloody good bloke. So, John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Julian.
And How does it feel being described as a comedy titan?
How does it feel being such a ledge?
Yeah, it is embarrassing. I said, please don't do that because I'm not any sort of ledge. It's just all hard work, really. And you wish people had been there in the 80s when it was really difficult.
So, in the 80s.
Yeah.
Why was it more difficult in the 80s?
Well, it wasn't. I just worked very hard in the 80s.
Oh, right, okay.
And, it's Spitting Image, for example. I used to beg them to fire me every day. It was so difficult, hard work. 2 hours sleep a night for 90 days in a row, that kind of stuff.
And, wow.
But, you know, I was very driven. I don't know why, but...
I thought everyone in the 80s was just drunk all the time. And
were drunk as well.
Oh, right, okay.
In fact, one time, the two of the writers, all the writers, there was Hislop and Newman, who were Private Eye guys, and Grant Naylor, Red Dwarf. They were the four main people that would see them every day.
This was on
Spitting Image.
This was on Spitting Image.
And one week I thought, I've got to give up the drinking, you know. And so I stopped drinking and said, Lloydie, please start drinking again. You're so focused and energetic, it's driving us mad. So I took it up again.
So yeah. how did Spitting Image come to be?
It was a long process. When I left radio in 78 to go to telly, and I'd specialised in sort of topical comedy on things like Weekending and the news headlines. And I knew a lot of people who did brilliant voices, a lot of people who could write brilliant topical jokes for Not the 9 o'clock News, but nobody who could. There wasn't a sort of a Mike Yarwood, Rory Bremner person who looked like the people.
Yeah.
So it's a sound only thing. So we had this idea of doing puppets.
Because they look more like the people.
Yeah. And I found out who Fluck and Law were because they used to do magazine covers in plasticine.
Wow.
And they were quite world famous and very, very poor. And I went to see Roger and I said, can you build a puppet for me? He said, I don't know, I've never built a puppet. How much money is it and in it? And I said, about 200 quid. He just laughed at me. So didn't see him again for another 3 or 4 years. And then somebody put up the first 10 grand to make a puppet of Nancy Reagan, I think, as a parrot.
Was that the first one?
Yeah, and I heard about this and I rushed over and I said, I'd done Not the 9 o'clock News about this. I said, I'm literally probably the only person in the world who can produce this for you. Because of the life experience that I'd had. Because
you went to...
I went to see Fluck and Law again.
Right,
I said,
you've
got to hire me. This is...
Right.
I know how to do this.
Yeah.
Because they didn't. And they said, we've already got two producers. So I sort of said, okay, well, I'll come work for you for nothing. So I did that for the first year.
Amazing.
Wow.
Because I was so determined to be part of it.
Did you expect Spitting Image to become such a hugely resonant part of the national consciousness?
Well, yes and no. I think Ben Elton, who was a close friend of mine at the time, oh, still is, but he was, you know, very young then, and he saw the first 3 or 4 puppets. He said, I've got to do this. This is amazing. We all had that sense that if we could get it right, it was going to be huge.
Yeah.
But not as huge as it was. I mean, when it was one time in the second series, I think, maybe the beginning of the third series, when it was number 2 in the ratings between two soaps.
Yeah,
and
it's
I
always
thought,
the soaps.
Oh, we've done this wrong. We're too popular.
It's incredible.
Somehow we're reaching people we didn't expect. I reckon above 10 million people, which you could easily get in those days. You think, well, you must have been pandering to people in some way.
Mm.
But the thing about Spitting Image was it's such a universal idea, which is that the people at the top are no better than you. In fact, they're just as idiotic and they all have pimples and big noses and all that sort of stuff. That's such a universally appealing thing that it got to everyone in different ways.
Mm.
So I remember falling asleep on the train back from Birmingham. I used to commute to Birmingham. The lorry went with all the puppets from Canary Wharf, where we worked, which was then just a warehouse.
And it was made in Birmingham?
Made in Birmingham because of union rules. Then we come back again. I come back on the train.
I didn't know that.
I came back dog-tired, had fallen asleep in the carriage, and there were these two old biddies cleaning the carriage with a mop and a bucket, you know, clunking around.
Yeah.
And one says to the other, did you see that Spitting Images on a telly last night? And the other one says, yeah, I love that show because I hate the fucking Queen. And I thought, my God, I've unleashed something terrible.
Yeah.
There's a thing, there's a sort of
terrible republicanism.
Well, it's a good dark idea. Underbelly, but it was done with such passion, you know.
Because it was brutal. Some of the depictions of people in those puppets was, I mean, God, I just imagine if you had a puppet made of you. I mean, it's a terrifying prospect.
Well, the first thing that would happen is you wouldn't recognise it.
Right. Because
nobody ever recognised their own puppet. And in the first series, John Blair, the other producer, he was the money guy and I was the script guy, basically. And they managed to sneak a puppet of both of us into a sort of party sketch at the end.
Right.
And I said to him, who's that? And he said, that's you. And I said, but no, that's you, but who's the other guy? He said, it's you. I said, I don't have a pointy head. He said, you do.
Amazing.
So that's like Donald Trump not recognising the parody of himself on Saturday Night Live by...
Definitely.
By,
what's you say, well, you say by it doesn't look anything like me.
Right, it does nothing like me.
Yeah.
Is there sort of a sense when you've done something so powerful like that you are actually affecting the political discourse?
Well, no, Roger's great dictum is Saturday, I don't do fuck all. That was his his decision after 13 years of it that it didn't make any difference. And I think that is, it's not true that it doesn't make any difference, but it doesn't make the difference you intended it would do. So there were quite a lot of, there was quite a broad spectrum politically amongst the people who put Spitting Image together, oddly, but there was definitely a strong, you know, left of centre bias and a lot of people who weren't very keen on the Thatcher administration. But I think, if anything, we probably kept it in power longer. My theory is that because it was only 3 years before Spitting Image started, we had the Toxteth riots, you know, and the country burning and there were riots all over London, and then the Falklands War happened and everyone, you know, came together as a national thing. But it was simmering, you know, there was a lot of anger. It was the most divisive government probably, certainly in my lifetime and probably since the war. So people were very polarized in terms of what they believed. And I think we gave the government a safety valve. I think rather than going out and rioting, people just said they'd just stay in.
That's really interesting.
I used to get these amazingly moving letters from people saying, my PO put them into two piles, nice and nasty. And the nasty ones all said, you're a communist bastard and I hope you get cancer and die. And the other half said, I've been unemployed for 8 years. And I'm desperate and I was going to kill myself last Sunday, but I thought I'd just have one last laugh before I go. And it was so funny, I thought I can last another week.
Mm.
That kind of stuff. Pretty powerful.
I don't know if we were talking about this the other week, but there was a Malcolm Gladwell podcast the other day where he speaks to Harry Enfield about loads of money, and he talks about satire actually being a bit counterproductive politically, because like you said, it can be everything to everyone, especially if it's good satire like Spitting Image was, and it allows people to think they're kind of taking revenge on the powers that be without actually having to do it to a degree.
There's truth in that. I think if you go and watch The Pub Landlord, which is an absolutely brilliant show, Al Murray, an absolute genius, but it is half the people who see it as satirical and half the people who think this guy's right, he should be prime minister,
like when he ran as a sort of UKIP candidate.
You can have it both ways.
But were you aware that you were sort of, you were quite in control of working out the common perception of people, or did you think you were actually creating the perception?
Well, satire tends to work as an enhancer, a reinforcer, so that if you say something, if you said, for example, the Queen is a really horrible person, most people wouldn't relate to that. They might not be a monarchist, but you don't think of the Queen as being an unpleasant person, for example. So you tend to play, oddly, quite often to sort of slightly Daily Mail cliches of things and enhance those. And it has to have a ring of truth. If it's so obviously, you know, if you thought, you know, John Major's an absolute, it's such an exciting disco dancing kind of guy, people would think, only take that as ironic. Whereas, you know, hello, that seemed to fit somehow.
Yeah, it really did.
I say that the odd effect, which having bumped into odd politicians over the years of Spitting Image, was that everybody, every 13-year-old in the country could have named 10 members of the cabinet and 4 members of the shadow cabinet without thinking about it.
Mm.
So that people were politically informed, and the politicians all miss that. They might not like their own puppet, but they sure as hell liked everybody else's.
Do you think that, I mean, how do you feel about modern satire? I mean, don't talk about our show because we don't want you to criticise it. But what do you think about the state of modern satire? Why is there not a Spitting Image now that is as popular?
There's not much of it. I know that the guy who runs BBC News is baffled why that isn't the case. Martin Rosen, the Guardian cartoonist, said to me, what was it? 2014 was the 30th anniversary of Spitting Image starting. And Martin Rosen said to me, this is the first government, the Cameron government, in my lifetime where the Prime Minister is not regularly lampooned on television.
Why do you think that is?
Nobody can understand that. Why not? I don't know. There's very little in this country, quite a lot in America. You know, John Oliver is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Another thing that I do relate to very well with John Oliver is that he's informing people. That's what I particularly like, in a very funny way. And I think, in a way, I've only ever had one idea, which is how can you get across interesting, perhaps important information in a way which is entertaining?
Mm.
Think about it. Spitting Image is politics and jokes.
Yeah.
Blackadder's history and jokes. QI is the universe and jokes. It's the same idea. Yeah, yeah. It's pathetic to have only had one idea in your life. But
no, I mean it's a good idea. People talk about. I mean, it's going, I mean, on that exact point, with not the 9 o'clock news, again, a huge, you know, stalwart of, you know, the satirical universe that was held up, you know, for many, many years as being, you know, exactly that sort of entertaining and informing. How did you get that across, and what were the kind of battles you had to fight to actually get that idea made?
I didn't have to. In those days, I turned up hoping for a job as a floor manager. I quit radio because I'm fed up with having formats pinched by other people and going other places. And I went for a job as a floor manager against the advice of my careers officer, as being too old at 27 to get in at the bottom. And the head of entertainment, light entertainment, said, "What kept you?" I said, "What?"
I think anyone who's ever done anything interesting is always going against the advice of their careers officer.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, Spitting Image was absolutely hated by a lot of people who were friends, you know. Right. You know, they said it was ugly and pointless.
Well,
and
we can relate to that.
And, well, no, I'm thinking if you're not doing that, you've made a mistake, because if everybody likes it immediately, but it's not universal, but not the 9 o'clock news. The review in The Guardian by Peter Fiddick, the television critic after the first show, was wankers. When you're in comedy, all you're trying to do is make people laugh, isn't it?
Yeah.
I certainly was astonished by how much people disliked it. Same with the first series of Blackadder, which...
Wow.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading about that. I mean, it was a bit before our time, but the second series was where it really blew up, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Why did they dislike the first series? What was the...
Well, we made a lot of mistakes that we then... I mean, they didn't seem like mistakes. We were trying to do something original and different.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, they're basically because the bunch of people that I know, they're basically stage... Yeah. They come from a stage background, so they need the audience for the comic timing. If you did, as we did in the first series of Blackadder, shoot it without an audience film, the timing all goes. We didn't know anything about editing or cutting. We were very grandiose. We were young and arrogant. We'd won a couple of BAFTAs on Not the 9 o'clock News. We all thought we knew what we were doing.
Yeah.
And so we overreached ourselves. The sets were too big. There were too many extras. We used actors who were famous but didn't necessarily work in comedy. And we went back to when it was cancelled by Michael Grade after the first series.
Unbelievable.
And we had to rewrite the whole thing over the weekend, the first four episodes of the second series.
Over a weekend?
Yeah. We took out all the film, took out all the extras.
And then you had to repitch it in order to get the second series commissioned.
And then we said it's what they call strand average budget. So same as a two-sofa sitcom.
Yeah.
So when you were, you know, if you were giving any advice to young writers out there or people pushing the thing, because you had a very obviously close partnership with Richard Curtis on that project. Do you think that's important, sort of directors and producers kind of pushing each other, or did you try and very much kind of facilitate one vision? Or was it about, you know, as we were talking about before we started, you know, a group of people in a sort of egalitarian way all having their say? Because there's a lot more hierarchy now than there used to be with creativity.
Well, people often say to me, what's the producer do? And I say, I don't really know. Sort of everything and nothing. But I think that, I suppose, some things that I try to do is I try to act as the writer or the actor's conscience to say, I know you can do better than that because you did better than that last week. And they go, well, I think it's really good. I think, well, it's just not. And you're doing a kind of thing that a lot of musicians do when they write songs. You're sort of channeling. And I often say, I work for the program. You don't work for me. I work for the program. And I'm sort of the program's intercessor on earth, if you like. You know, I'm sort of channeling. This is what the program is, what it stands for, what it does. You know, and I think when you see a program that's got editorial confidence, you think, oh, well, I'm trying to think of one. You know, Monty Python would never have done that.
Yeah, yeah.
You just think, well, they just wouldn't. It would be totally naff. They wouldn't have done that. I hope the same is true of QI or you know, Spitting Image or whatever. The thing is, there's a sense that they know why they're doing it, what for. And so it's trying to get that, and then I'm not an auteur in any sense. The team is the thing that I think is important, is to try and create a microculture where people feel they can say what they think, and where people are not after winning the battle. They want their idea to be in. They want the best idea. Chris Langham, who was in the first series of Not the 9 o'clock News, was offered the job of head writer on The Muppets. And he was really completely poleaxed that somebody should offer him such an amazing job with such a huge international show. And he said, what should I do? How do I do this? I don't know how to do this. And Jim Henson said, all you have to do, Chris, is be in the service of the best idea.
Yeah.
Be the servant of the best idea. And that's something I've never forgotten. forgotten that.
The ideas you don't have ideas, they have you.
That's right.
Which is
I know it sounds weird, but anyone who's ever had an idea who's honest knows that's the case.
Well, it's memetics, isn't it? Which is Richard Dawkins' theory, which actually changed my life. Philosophical theory, which takes us smoothly on to your very philosophical starter, which you've brought, John Lloyd.
We've had the metaphorical canapés.
Do
you like a canapé, John?
Delish.
I love one. I love it.
You're a big starters guy. Do you like a three-course meal? Is that your kind of thing?
Well, I was at school with a bloke called Worrell Thompson, who become a famous restaurateur.
Yeah.
And he had a thing, a restaurant down the King's Road that only served starters and puddings.
Ooh.
Very successful. It
sounds
great.
Like a cereal cafe.
You
really were the original hipsters, weren't you?
Yeah.
A restaurant that only serves puddings and starters. Bloody hell. Would you like to introduce your starter for us, John Lloyd, and tell us what you've brought?
Well, I'd like to talk about what we should teach children right from the off. That's a thing that interests me.
Tasty.
Be seen and not heard type stuff.
They're definitely that. Yeah. I often think that my children, I've got three of them who are now in their 20s, that they taught me all that I know that's worth knowing. All little children ask all the big questions, including all the big philosophical questions, right from the start. And the problem is that most parents are in that part of their career where they're very busy. They haven't really got time to do anything. They're rushing to get people to school so they can get to the office, and they're not grown up as parents. They're cross, or they're confused, or they've suddenly realized they've married a complete loony. That commonly happens. And so the atmosphere is very tense, and people aren't listening to what the children have to say and ask. And they certainly don't know the answers to the questions like, why is the sky blue, Dad?
Well, we're in the middle of a big blue eyeball, and we're up in
God, darling.
One of your mate Douglas's sort
Santa Claus,
Hitchhiker Guide to the Galaxy sort of scenarios.
So, I
give you an example
of
a thing I often
you
say.
You think they should be educated? They should be taught philosophy. You think
and physics?
The first thing is a lot of things in life that I think are so is if I had to describe my primary. Way of approaching the world is it's an acronym called ITOWU. It's the other way up. You won't go far wrong in life if you look at every situation, particularly difficult ones, and you think maybe it's the opposite of what it appears
right
to be.
Yeah.
So
hang on, let me get my head around this. So what you're saying is if you're approaching a difficult question for our audience, you flip it on its head and you'll get the right answer. Is that
not necessarily, but it's a very good way of approaching it. For example, try and see the other person's point of view is a very good rule for
empathy. Social
interaction. If you think every day the sun appears, doesn't it, to come up in the east, go overhead and go down in the west, but we now know, what scientists tell us, it's the opposite way around. The sun is staying relative to the earth where it is,
right.
And the earth is revolving towards it in a certain direction.
Copernicus and Galileo.
Similarly, you probably know this, when you look at anything, the light that hits your retina coming through your eyes, actually the image is upside down and the brain is turning it up.
Flipping it around again.
So those are two quite big things that are the other way up to the way they seem. My theory about parenting is you won't go far wrong. I'm not sure if I believe in reincarnation or not, but I think it's quite an interesting theory. You won't go far wrong if you behave with children as if they've been sent to teach you something the other way about.
This is so true. I went to see my godson this weekend, and he was saying all these things all the time that just make you... he was teaching me, just like you said. I felt like I was seeing things from a completely different perspective. And even in the way I had to explain things to him made me rethink what it is to be me and what it is to be human. I was in the room and I was sort of packing my bag and I was going to football and I sprayed some deodorant on and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, when you grow up and you're an adult, you start to smell." "You don't smell, you're just a child, but adults like us, we smell. So you have to spray a nice smelling smell on your armpits to make yourself smell better." And I thought, that is so weird. And I looked at his face, and his face was like, "You are mad. Yeah. That is a weird thing to do." And I totally reevaluated my sort of, you know, my understanding of spraying deodorant.
To be fair though,
Haid,
after a couple of weeks of being in, you know, in sort of random costumes with Haid, you know, it gets a bit punchy, doesn't it? So
it's
definitely logic. I mean, it was good enough for the Egyptians,
wasn't
it? That's
a brilliant story. If you ever have to explain the facts of life to a small child, you think, "You do what?
Yeah,
you put it where?" It's certainly everything.
John Lloyd, I'm not going to even talk about what you're talking about putting wear there. But
so Harry, who's now 26, when he was about, I don't know, four or something.
This is your son?
Yeah, taking him to nursery school. And he says, who's that man, Dad? I said, I don't know, some guy. Why is he getting into that car? I don't know. But why is he getting into the car, Dad? Well, he's obviously probably going to work, Harry. Why is he going to work, Dad? Oh, for Christ's sake, you know, Jesus. Just don't ask
Shut
me
up
to
and
go
drink
to the
gin.
Swings. he's going to work, Has, because he has to earn money to buy food. Well, why does he have to do that, Dad? Oh, God. Mm. Well, because if he doesn't have any food in the house, Harry, his wife and children will all die. Understand? And Harry goes, Dad, why do things want to live? Oof. And you go, ooh, that is that a question or what?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that.
Who does?
No. We sort of stop asking
so the thing is
ourselves
you,
those questions.
If you like, you're talking to your godson, if you start listening, somebody said, this is a bit of a New Age cliche, but we have two ears and one mouth so we can listen twice as much as we speak, you know, and nobody does that. Everybody talks too much. Mm. So that thing is educating children. The first thing is to, I think education is a form of graduated lying. You know, if you see a school model of an atom, it looks like a set of snooker balls, doesn't it, collected by drinking straws.
Yeah.
And it's about, you know, 6 or 7 inches across and it's red and white. And it's nothing, it's not even slightly like how an atom works.
Yeah.
An atom, the simplest atom in the universe is a hydrogen atom. So if you imagine something like, I don't know, a Malteser in the center spot of Wembley Stadium.
Yeah.
And the electron, it is one electron, neutrons, just one proton, one electron. There's the Malteser in the middle of Wembley Stadium. Right up at the top of the stadium is this sort of thing like a cloud of gnats.
Yeah.
Wow.
Floating around. It's not really a thing.
It's not really spinning around. It's appearing in different places.
Yeah, and it's not fixed in a, like a structure.
Mm.
And, you know, it's often said that there's more empty space relatively inside an atom than there is in the solar system.
Mm.
All the things you tell the kids, and that then you, as they get older, you say, no, well, it's not quite true.
Yeah.
And the same is true of education. You know, when you get to beyond PhD level, you start learning things about physics and philosophy that aren't taught.
I feel like this about politics, because I feel, you jump maybe 10 years when kids are sort of like 17, 18 years old, and you're really idealistic, and you say things like, but why do we have to have nuclear weapons? Mm. And adults always go, well, it's very complicated, and it's because of this. Or why do we have to have war? And you're sort of super idealistic, and you believe you can change it. And then slowly you get old, and you become slightly more cynical, and you kind of... You get more into the sort of nuance of the argument, and you lose that kind of really innocent question, which is an incredible question to ask. And I think, I don't know, I feel like I've kind of lost it. I'm only 35, and I feel like I've kind of got there already. I've lost some of my idealism that I perhaps wouldn't have had when I was 18.
You need to ask, don't you? I mean, this is one of the effects that children had on me, is that I used to be so anxious for them. That, you know, we lived in Fulham at the time, and driving home, and if I'd hear a fire engine, I thought, What if the flat's burned down and everybody's dying? What would I do? I couldn't cope with the level of anxiety. So I set out to find out, you know, think about what I thought about life and death and why. Question is, what are we doing here?
Mm.
What's the point of being alive? And I think that's one of the things we don't address in education is, you know, what does it mean to be a person? What's the optimal way of living? How do you get through life with less pain than most of us suffer every day?
Well, let's hold there for a second, because we're going to go like into that, I think, a bit later with our meaty main.
Yeah.
But I think what you're talking about, this why are we so trapped in these educational paradigms? I mean, before the recording, you and I had a brief conversation about Ken Robinson. And if you haven't heard of Ken Robinson at home, Ken Robinson is an educational guru, essentially. And he did a wonderful talk about the realities of the system that we're currently living in. It belonged to a different industrial age, as in kids, when they're born, they're all put in the same year group, as if the thing they've got most in common is their year of manufacture, where actually one kid's a lot better at maths, another kid's a lot better at geography, and actually it would actually help level them out if they're all in one place. Now, you've actually spent some time talking to Ken Robinson about these things, haven't you? What's your take on why it's so sort of intransigent?
Well, like anything else in the world of ideas, when when an idea comes along that takes, it's so obvious, isn't it? I mean, it's not the case, for example, when Darwin came up with the theory of evolution on the, in the Origin of Species, people didn't, by and large, go, oh, this is complete rubbish and God will be... Most people go, oh, why didn't I think of that? Yeah. That's brilliant.
It's been staring me in the face the whole time.
And similarly with when Copernicus came up with the idea that this is another other way up thing. You know, it wasn't the sun going around the world, it was the world going around the sun. But he couldn't prove it was just an idea. And then along came Kepler and Galileo. Yeah. But it was Kepler who, because the figures didn't work, if it was the other way around, because they thought it was a circular orbit, and Kepler came along and said, if it's an ellipse, all the figures that Tycho Brahe, the great Danish astronomer, had got together, they all suddenly worked.
But wasn't
Then immediately everyone agreed. And it's not the case, for example, from that point. Most people historically have not believed the world's flat. Nearly everybody's always believed it's round.
Yeah. Wasn't it true, though, that Copernicus only published that theory posthumously? His friend published it for him, and had he actually published it during his lifetime, he probably would have been...
Done for heresy. Probably,
exactly. Yeah.
Just to say, anyone at home who doesn't know the answer to any of these questions, I don't, so don't feel on your own. These two very intelligent men here having this conversation, it's just a normal chat down the pub, but these are very intelligent men. Why is this knowledge so...
It's not really about intelligence. It's about asking questions rather than... I sometimes say to you, inducting new QI researchers, about once every 2 years we find the perfect person, and I say to them, any fool can find answers, especially now, but the difficult thing is think of a new question.
That's a
and if you can do
way
that,
to put it.
Yeah. And that's what children do all the time. Why do things want to live? Dad, does God look after burglars?
I didn't even ask that.
Is that brilliant? And the other one he said was, he was about 13 this time, we're talking about hydrogen, I think. And he says, Dad, why is there something and not nothing?
That's a good one.
Wow.
That is the key question, actually.
What scientists are still exploring that
they
question.
They don't know.
Constantly,
just to ask
nobody
John
knows that
they
question.
Are physicists generally right now are exploring all the kinds of questions that kids would ask, basically.
But the thing they don't do, we'll come onto this in a minute, I think, the why question is the same. That's what terrifies most conventional scientists, not the great ones, but the conventional ones, is... I remember having an argument with a famous chemist in a pub in Oxford, and you know, who was absolutely, you know, materialist as they come. Being a chemist, you might expect so. And he said, "I think questions like why is the universe here at all should be made illegal."
Are you serious? Did you
have something? No, because you see, it's not a question science can answer.
Not an
philosophy
empirical
can answer that. Right. Guesswork, but science can't prove anything like that, and so it.
What I love about the idea of a physicist discovering, because that's what they're doing, discovering a scientific theory or an equation like Einstein did with relativity, is that that isn't something that Einstein has created and formulated in his own mind and written it as a novelist might write a novel. It's something that he's just happened upon, like a miner might happen upon a nugget of gold or whatever. It's the implications of E equals MC squared had... expressions in the world that not even Einstein believed. He discovered something that had implications that he did not believe. He discovered a theory that created quantum physics. He didn't even believe in quantum physics.
No.
I find that amazing that this thing, this theory, E equals MC squared, existed somewhere. Where was it? Wasn't in his mind, wasn't in reality. You couldn't see, you couldn't like actually pull back a curtain and actually see the, you know, the equation sitting there waiting for you to understand it. It was somewhere in this sort of, in the ether, in this metaphysical world, just waiting for it to be discovered. I find that incredible. And it was there from the beginning of time.
But I think
and he just happened on it.
Yeah, we're not really taking into account here, and it's sort of interesting because you were talking about as a child, and then, Hayde, you were mentioning, you know, the political system. We're talking about, you know, scientists now. There was this great book by a guy called Rupert Sheldrake called The Science Delusion, and it basically says that a lot of people think...
Massively debunked.
What his basic theorem is that the rules of science aren't set. It should be about exploratory work. But it has... When you do anything that's exploratory, and likewise with politics, you know, when you do anything exploratory, you are undermining the status quo. And there are the powers that be do not like to be undermined. So, John Lloyd, how do we ask these kind of questions and have rational dialogues, whether it's education or children, without this kind of huge backlash, or is that just inevitable?
Well, one of the things about science, briefly, is that one of the ways of looking at it is that science is the history of correcting mistakes, things that then turn out not to be quite true. So Einstein did some corrections to Newton and extended the range of where things can be uncertain. Mm-hmm. Quantum theory, again, took Einstein and went on forwards to a point where Einstein didn't share some of those ideas. Mm. But nobody's ever... Relativity is, along with quantum mechanics, is one of the most successful theories that's ever been come up with, and E equals MC squared is definitely, as far as we know, that anything is the case, that is the case.
Can you just explain it to me? Because I think, like, maybe I'm just a bit stupid, but I don't really necessarily, like, can you just explain that, what does it mean in layman's terms?
It means relativity. That matter and energy are the same thing, but not, they're equivalent to one another,
right?
But by a very different proportion. So energy equals mass times the speed of light squared.
God, doesn't sound complicated at all.
What that means is you get a very large amount of energy from a very, very small amount of matter.
All right,
so an atom bomb is, you know, is even a handful of whatever element they use to blow up. That handful can destroy an entire city, no problem. So matter and energy are equivalent, but it only takes a very small amount of matter to make a very large amount of energy.
I mean, I'm not trying to be like Philomena Clunk here or anything, but I do find some of this stuff quite difficult, and I think this is one of the reasons that
maybe it's difficult.
Sort of becomes hard to get your head around. No, but it's all... Look, for me, it was always like the best teachers were people who could give us metaphors that made sense. And I think, you know, the thing that's difficult as a parent, certainly I'm not a parent, but a lot of young sort of families that I see, we're in our mid-30s, all of our friends having kids, it's difficult, isn't it, to find the right metaphor. Maybe that's why they close them down, because they don't know how to sort of tangibly find a way to explain something. It must be quite challenging. I mean, did you find, was having children the biggest challenge?
Yeah, much harder than working. And it never goes away. I mean, the
they never go away.
Stop.
I hope they
just
never will. No, it is very difficult, because the thing is, it's not about... You know, children are fine, nearly, unless they're born brain damaged or whatever, they're absolutely fine.
Heaven forfend.
So my rules of parenting these days are, be nice and leave them alone. You know, right. If they ask for help and if they're hungry, fine, give them whatever they want. But basically be nice, that's all you have to do. And
much
they
like
will
a
grow
sort of...
in their own. Don't try and mould them, force them, don't order them about, certainly don't punish them. That's completely futile.
Let
them become. Like a pot plant.
Yeah.
It's like exactly
cheap
like garden.
Kids like a pot plant.
That's why people
I mean, nobody
are listening
shouts
to this
at
podcast.
A tree saying, "What the hell are you doing, tree? You pathetic thing. Look at the state of your leaves. Go to your room."
I have done that.
You're
actually
growing towards the light. What are you doing over there? You should be pushing over there into the neighbour's garden. I mean, listen, that was one hell of a starter.
Could I just say I've got a little theory, just a little theory quickly.
Oh, you have a theory?
I've got a little theory. I think kids should... Do you think...
Is this your theory?
This is my theory.
This is
yours. Going to say from my mouth into the mic.
Is
that basically, why don't we teach kids about our fuck-ups historically? Okay, we should definitely teach them about philosophy and physics. I'm down with your starter. It's a good idea to me. But we should also teach them about our historical fuck-ups. The nicest people in the world, I reckon, right now, are the Germans. Do you know why? Because they teach their kids how massively they effed up back in the day. And they're so conscious and aware of the implications of
That's
their actions.
Very good.
And the actions
it's an Ito-Woo thing.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's the reverse of what you think.
They
the other thing
it.
We should teach, there should be a weekly lesson on ignorance. The things that we don't know.
That's a great idea.
That's what we. That's why I'm Professor of Ignorance at Southampton Central University.
That's your honorary doctorate, isn't it?
Official Professor of Ignorance.
John, should we move on to the main course? What have you brought us for your meaty main?
I'm going to talk. I'd like to talk about the big question, the what they call in science the hard question, and that is consciousness.
Everywhere and nowhere.
Where does it come from? I'd like to start with a quotation from the Macmillan Dictionary of Psychology, again, 1989, edited by Stuart Sutherland. Consciousness is a fascinating but elusive phenomenon. It is impossible to specify what it is, what it does, or why it evolved. Nothing worth reading has been written on it.
Wow.
I mean, I studied philosophy at uni, and then I sort of immediately forgot it 6 months after I left uni. I think it was probably because I really liked the theories, but so much of the degree was dedicated to discussing why the theories weren't right. But I didn't care whether the theories were right or wrong. I just liked the theories.
Hmm.
No, it's just the idea that...
I agree. I think that's one of the key things about the way philosophy is not taught properly. Mm. The way philosophy started was it was after the sophists, who were the so-called wise guys.
That's right,
They thought they knew stuff.
Yeah. And the Sophists were the Greeks who...
They were the people, lovers of wisdom. Mm. They wanted to know what the proper answer, what the right, useful answers were. And for the ancient Greeks, philosophy is a kind of workshop manual of human life. You know, how should we behave? You know, what would help us to behave? If we behave better, would that make a difference? And what it's become now is a sort of logic chopping thing. Yeah, no, but that isn't what Nietzsche said. I don't really, for me, I don't care what Nietzsche said. I want to say, what did he say that I can take away that will help me?
Yeah, exactly.
Which I'm sure is what he was trying to do.
For me, nowadays, I mean, you know, apart from sort of, you know, cups of tea with Hayden and various other people at university, I mean, it's in the mainstream culture in ways like The Matrix, you know, like brains in vats, you know, people getting obsessed with these ideas. And then obviously, I mean, now it's sort of spiritual seekers, you know, people who talk about ayahuasca and connecting to something in this kind of shamanic sort of way. And certainly, are you aware of the work of Graham Hancock?
Yes, very much so.
So, I mean,
and
what
Rupert Sheldrake.
Yeah, so Graham Hancock, and I mean, the other thing that connects Graham Hancock and Rupert Sheldrake were they're two people who've had their TED Talks banned.
Yes.
And in that, he talks about, Graham Hancock talks about this idea that maybe the worst person you can possibly talk to about consciousness is a materialist scientist, because they just believe that we are basically just engines and then die. And then what he believes is that essentially we are much more, the brain could be much more akin to a TV set receiving a TV signal.
Is that Hancock?
Yeah, that's what Hancock thinks.
Oh, that's what I think. Interesting. I didn't know that.
And is that, so what do you think that too? You think that there is a possibility of that? And what's led you to that kind
What do
of
you
conclusion?
Mean a TV?
Well, I think what he's saying is, right, that basically, like, if you think about all the things that people have spoken about, whether it's telepathy or intuition, or the I mean, what Hancock talks about initially in his book as well is this idea that, have you ever felt someone looking at you? Have you ever felt someone? And if you have, then there's nothing in modern science that could explain that.
Yeah.
And the idea is that essentially that maybe consciousness is actually sort of somehow being beamed to us somehow. So it's sort of everywhere and nowhere. So, John, what for you is sort of the core question that we're not asking in the kind of consciousness debate?
Okay, well, it's very easy to say with the Itawu theory. It's the other way up.
I love Itawu.
Okay, so I think you could start a religion based on that.
Itawu, it sounds like a good... Yeah, sounds good.
Itawu!
So
the common wisdom, the accepted wisdom from neuroscientists and everyone else, is that consciousness is what they call an emergent property of the brain.
Mm.
So in some way, the brain creates this sense of self-awareness that we all have, or appear to have, because as far as I know, You could all be holograms.
Mm.
I've no Hayden way of knowing is. That you're real.
Mm.
And I think the other way up thing with consciousness is, I think that matter, including the brain and everything else in the universe, is an emergent property of consciousness.
Right.
The consciousness is all there is. The right. only reality is this single undivided thing. It has no dimension.
Mm.
Empedocles, the great Greek philosopher, says the universe is a circle whose circumference is nowhere and whose center is everywhere.
Yeah.
When you get into these sort of paradoxical things, the Greeks have been thinking of these things forever, and so have the Hindus, because one of the basic tenets of Hinduism is consciousness is the ground of being.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So that there's this thing which doesn't even think, it's just conscious. It's very difficult to also explain what it means to be conscious but not thinking. If you are very good at meditating, you'll know what that means, which I'm not. But I can explain it in a simple analogy. When you're driving down the motorway and you're having a really interesting conversation with somebody, you suddenly think, my God, we're at Bristol already.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So you're completely conscious. All your limbs are working. You've been driving the car. You've been paying total attention, but you're not actually thinking.
And for anyone listening to this in the car, you missed your turning.
This is subjective idealism. This is Berkeley, isn't it? This is saying that nothing exists other than what we perceive to exist, and colours aren't in the real world. They're an aspect of your consciousness. The sensation of heat is just a product of your, a creation of your consciousness.
Well, there's no way of knowing, is there? And this is what people like Elon Musk are thinking about, that we're in a computer simulation.
Yeah, I mean, that is fascinating. Yes. For anyone who doesn't know, like, Elon Musk is basically saying that when you really think that there could only be one reality, the mathematical probability that this reality is the reality becomes infinitesimally small.
Mm.
And that in itself makes me believe that both you two are possibly holograms. Yes. I reckon John, quite possibly a lizard controller rather than a hologram.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, if you think about John and everything he's done already, he's pushed a lot of buttons. John, have you ever considered that you may be a lizard controller rather than a hologram?
Or? Well, the lizard, shape-shifting lizard thing, like a lot of things, it's a sort of a religion, isn't it?
It is.
A cult belief. And
based
like a lot
on
of
very
these
little.
Things, I think...
Well, this is... Should we,
they're
the,
all...
They,
this he's is, got a, he's a, he has got a point, but it's not that... He's not quite... correct about.
Do you want to explain what it is? The lizard theory is what's his name?
Famous footballer turned absolute crazy man, BBC, David Icke.
David Icke. He was a BBC presenter at one point.
He was.
I went to a talk of his in Brixton
well, it
Academy.
It wasn't a talk, was it?
No,
it was
I went
just a ramble.
It was a 16-hour talk.
Jesus.
Of David Icke in Brixton Academy, and I tell you, Brixton. I've never seen Brixton Academy so packed.
It was banging.
It
wasn't
was full of people, and they listened to him for 16 hours straight. And he was saying things like, and I took pictures because it was hilarious. He was saying things like, "Halloween is a gateway ceremony for Satanism. It gets kids into Satanism. It like eases them into Satanism." Oh. He thinks the moon projects rays onto humanity to control them because, you know, at the lizard god's bidding. Mm. He is completely mental.
I reckon he went a bit too far on that ayahuasca and maybe had a couple of those mushroom teas at the same time and it was it was gone.
Yeah, and the thing is, just because it sounds a bit weird that consciousness is the grand being and consciousness and all there is, because obviously it... Sorry, this isn't very funny, but...
One John, it's
I,
all right.
One of the things I think is that everything in the universe is a paradox. So matter and antimatter, you know, you may know that the universe is... The amount of negative energy in the form of gravity and the amount of positive energy in the form of matter exactly cancel each other out. So mathematically, the universe is just a very, very long-winded way of expressing zero. And that is the case.
That's so Douglas Adams. Yeah. That is,
was his old roommate.
His roommate, John Lewis.
For anyone who doesn't know that, Douglas Adams.
Who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Wonder Man. Yeah. And you two must have had amazing chats over
did.
Coffee in the morning.
Absolutely unbelievable. And then Richard Dawkins got to Douglas.
Really?
And converted him to heavy-duty atheism.
No.
It was never quite the same about that. Because I have nothing against people of any religious belief as long as they're not hurting other people.
Feel the same.
And what happened to religious freedom? I thought we were allowed to think what we like.
Totally, yeah.
He became a bit of a zealot, didn't he,
Richard became,
Dawkins?
Well, and Douglas, too.
Yeah, really?
And it got... You did used to get... Yeah.
I can't imagine...
Do you want to talk about this over supper? I mean, can we talk about something else?
Can you tell us about the book that you wrote with Douglas Adams? Just quickly.
What, The Meaning of Life?
Yes.
Okay. Well, as some people may know, I helped Douglas write... He got stuck with the first series of Hitchhiker's Guide on the radio, and then when it became a... I helped him out the last couple of episodes. We were best mates. We had next-door offices in the BBC, and we shared a house together.
Wow.
And then he fired me, which was very upsetting at the time.
As your best mates do.
Honestly, I'm so grateful he did.
Hayden's tried to fire me loads of times.
I've tried, yeah.
I would never have done anything else. I'd have just been known as Douglas Adams and the other one.
Right.
I'd have been that bloke who helps him out when he gets stuck. But as a result of being fired, we'd already booked the holiday to write, well, the holiday, working holiday, to write the first Hitchhiker book in Corfu. And so I had spent the money that I thought I was getting as an advance for the book, so I went anyway. And it was a bit frosty for the first couple of days, but we were very close friends, and we made it up. And while we were there, Douglas used to pretend to be a novelist. Never written a novel before, and he'd sit there in a big hat, you know.
Don't know anyone
like
that.
A typewriter. And then about 11 o'clock, he'd get bored, and he'd come down to the taverna on the sea, where I would be sitting, opening my first bottle of Retsina.
Yeah,
lovely.
We'd play games all day. And one of the games was something his old English master at school had taught him, which is you take a place name and you say, what is this? What's a York? You know, what's a Darlington?
Yeah.
Okay. And so we would try and guess what this was. And I think the very first one we came up with was, what's an Ely?
Yeah.
And an Ely is the first tiniest inkling that something somewhere has gone terribly wrong. You know that
little Ely
get in there?
Yeah.
And a Wembley is the hideous moment of confirmation.
Oh, no.
The disaster presaged by the Ely has finally struck.
I'm a Tottenham fan, mate. That is a regular thing for
me. So you wrote a book about this?
It's a whole book.
An
well,
entire
been several
glossary
versions.
Of terms.
Three of them now.
Incredible.
Wow.
So it's quite fun when you're driving through the countryside and you see one of them on a signpost.
Give us another one. Give us another one.
Well, at Didcot, where I live, at Didcot, in the old days when they had ticket inspectors, they used to do a clip, a little bit out of your ticket. It was a little L shape, and those are didcots.
That's a didcot.
The tiny little bits
like
of
a chad.
Yes. Yeah. It is not well known that at Princess Margaret's wedding, there wasn't confetti, but millions of didcots were showered upon them by the
amazing.
I love that.
Are there any particular books that you would recommend, sort of when you're talking about that sort of getting to five, the big questions, like especially with the physics and philosophy things, people might find that, you know, a bit not that attainable for them. But are there any particular books you'd recommend that could be quite useful for new parents?
No, I don't think there is one. And I don't think the thing is that there isn't one that deals with all of these things. I have one brilliant tip. I suppose this is probably particularly for dads, but certainly for working mums as well. You know that thing where kids keep coming into the room, you know, they come downstairs, they go, Dad, Mum, yes, darling, look, Daddy and I have had a very long day, it's our time now, we're having a little glass of wine, could we talk about it tomorrow? But Dad, or, you know, you're on the important phone call to LA and you're just about to close the deal and, you know, Coco comes in, Dad, can we do Lego? yes, darling, I'm just on the phone to the head of Paramount. Could we just, 10 minutes, do you mind? Now, Dad, how do you stop that? How do you stop children bothering you, bugging you all the time when things are important? And the answer is this. When a child asks you something, no matter how absurd or ridiculous it may seem or how inappropriate, give it to them or do it immediately they ask.
Yeah.
Say to the guy on the phone, excuse me, something just come up, I'll call you straight back.
Yeah.
You know, put the glass of wine down, go and read them a bedtime story. Do it without stint, every time they ask. Doesn't matter whether it's for money or going to the swings or anything else. And after about a year, they stop asking.
No, really?
And they never ask you again.
Amazing.
Because they know you'll always be there. And that's all children want to know is you're always on their side, no matter what. Always on their side. Well, always believe in
it. Just attention seeking.
It's protection, it really isn't it? It's feeling protected.
And if you do that, you will learn something. And this is the other point about education is the mark of a great teacher is how often they elicit from children a question they themselves cannot answer. Exactly. If a teacher does that, you will never forget them.
We are going to move on. But, John, you know, I find a lot of the time that people just think the point of life is money. Right? And why do you think it is? Why have we got to this point now? You know, it's 2017. Why are so many people just obsessed with money? What's your observation about that?
Well, one of the things I had this, as you may have heard or read or researched, I had this major midlife crisis when I was 42, all hitchhikery sort of ages to have it at.
It's one of the first things we talked about.
Yeah, and I was conventionally, completely ridiculously successful at that sort of age. You know, I'd won lots of prizes and had plenty of money and had a couple of kids. And one day I thought, I can't see the point of going on. I wake up on Christmas Eve and I thought, I can't see the point of this. What's the point? I've done it. I've got all the things I want. Do I need another award, another BAFTA? Should I go for an Oscar? Would that be? And so I had this terrible descent into the ninth circle of hell and blundering around very depressed and very cross. And when I look back at it now, I think it's because I think I got to the buffers of a materialist life as far as I was concerned, you know. I had everything that you could achieve that I wanted. I didn't want a yacht particularly or to own an island. Money and fame and achievement. Over a certain amount, the amount of money you have is not really there. It's not really about the money. It's about keeping score, as I think Donald Trump said recently. And possessions are not there because you don't need another car. It's really to impress other people with how important you are, because you usually have a very low self-esteem. Not caring what other people think is another paradox. It's something you absolutely should do. You mustn't care what other people think. And also you must care what they think, if you see the difference. Because if you care what other people think and you pander them all the time, nobody in program making, for example, nobody will get what they really want. Whereas if you don't listen to what other people think and care what they think, like your children, for example, you're going to be a horrible person. So materialism is really not about you. You don't need anything. It's about the good opinion of other people. And somebody once said, you possess only whatever will not be lost in a shipwreck. When you start to get ill, how important is your Ferrari collection? The things that start to become important are friendship, you know. Whereas riches, fame, and success are a bit like heroin or alcohol. The more you have, the more you need to keep to the same level. And friendship's not like that. It's just a level playing field. Friendship always delivers. A good friend is never boring, It's always there for you. And interestingness, oddly enough, is another quality like that. You never get bored doing QI research. You can keep on doing it. It never stops delivering. Mm. You don't need to have more interestingness than last week. You just need exactly the same. Sort of simple ideas like living in the moment and not thinking, not caring about what other people think, being nice to people and having friends and doing what you believe in, doing something you love. Those are very much.
So we sort of need to renegotiate our idea of what we see as success, don't we?
Have you got kids?
No.
Not that he knows about. I mean, there might be some. If you want to write in or tweet in that you're Hayden's kid, then you know we'll definitely have a look at that. Anyway, John, I'm feeling a bit peckish. I could do something sweet.
I want
some
dessert. Yeah.
Do you like a dessert? Are you a dessert?
No,
man?
I'm not really a pudding person. No, not really. No,
and
occasionally.
Are you more like a cheese board?
Like. Yeah, I like a bit of coffee and ice cream.
Yeah, nice.
That's good.
So, what have you brought for dessert today then?
Well, leading on from the consciousness thing, I'd like to talk about artificial intelligence and robotics because it's much in the news, as you know, particularly this idea that robots are going to take over the world and control us and you know, they're all much cleverer than we are. And I think this is, I'm not of that party. I think that although artificial intelligence does some very interesting things, what your smartphone does is amazing. You know, as everyone said, there's more computing power in the average phone than it was in the Apollo 11 module that landed on the moon. And driverless cars are extraordinary. They will reduce accidents probably by 90%. A bit spooky, but you go on driverless trains to Gatwick and backwards and forwards, don't you? That's not a problem.
So you don't think it's a... You're not scared?
I don't think it's a problem. I think because what these particular kinds of machines have, the computer that runs the driverless trains or the robot that cleans your house or whatever, is something called artificial narrow intelligence. Mm. It's a limited or weak artificial intelligence, which does one specific thing that it's told to do very well. Mm. So it's taught how to play chess. It has all the possibilities of every chess move in its mind, or Go is another thing that it's just got very good at, and it can do that. But the same computer that can beat any human being at chess can't do like a simple thing that we do every day, like tie a pair of shoelaces. So they're specialists. And the thing is, what the great goal of AI is artificial general intelligence, which is where a computer can do anything better than human, and we have got nowhere. Consciousness has been studied quite seriously for about 100 years. Not only does nobody know where it is or what it is, a bit like dark matter or dark energy, but there's absolutely no progress in getting a computer to be conscious in any way, to be self-aware, as far as we know.
According to Ray Kurzweil, who is now Google's head of blue sky thinking or something like that, he believes that there will be a tipping point, at which point he uses the term the singularity, at which point computers will become as intelligent and more so than humanity, because they will educate themselves after they go over a certain
cusp. I'm not with him at all. I just was reading an article by him in Time magazine earlier today. The number of books you buy called How the Brain Works, don't bother to read it because they don't know. That's the end of the matter. Nothing intelligent or interesting been written about consciousness except by philosophers, really, and religious people, including Thomas Aquinas.
But I think some people
it's not my idea, this, you know, that goes back to the dawn of, since people could write and record things, the idea that consciousness is the thing. So the problem with, I remember reading a paper at the beginning of QI when I believed that artificial intelligence was going to take over the world.
Oh, so you did used to believe that?
Yeah, I thought, of course. And there was this paper by three PhD students saying, not only have we not created artificial intelligence, we haven't even created artificial stupidity.
Right.
And that is something that a robotics professor, AI professor at Oxford, told me the other day. He said, I've been in this business 40 years, we've got absolutely nowhere.
Yeah.
By which he meant not in artificial narrow intelligence, but in general intelligence and in what they call super intelligence, which is where a computer is millions of times better than every human
being. Like HAL. So we're not going to have any HALs anytime soon.
So the thing is, they're looking, one of these things, they're looking in the wrong direction. If you have a brain damage or a disease which removes the part of the brain in which you have emotions, you'd think, wouldn't you, that'd be a lovely thing to have, because you'd be a kind of psychopath. You'd be able to make decisions without the baggage of things like embarrassment or compassion. Quite the reverse. A person who has no emotions literally can't get out of the chair because they don't see the point. Why would he get out of the chair? If I have no desire. If you have no desire, no motivation, you can't do anything. And that's what computers are like. And until you have proper artificial intelligence, they have to be motivated.
Well, I've seen this argued the other way. I went to this Wired conference and there was this amazing guy who's the he was kind of basically the father of deep learning. And he says that, in exactly what you would say, that essentially for a computer, it would sense, just like you do when you're hungry, that its battery was low. And so therefore, it would get up to plug itself in. So there are kind of, you know, that we are ultimately, in his thinking, a set of algorithms, a set of kind of, you know, processes just to do X, Y, or Z, you know, because essentially an algorithm is just a recipe is an algorithm, essentially, you know, just how different steps to take. But what I find interesting about what you're saying is that you moved from one viewpoint to the other. And what was the core moment when you were like, right, you know what? We don't need to worry about this too much. We're never going to be able to translate what humans do.
The effect of my appalling, I was certainly about 10 years, 8 years anyway, in the wilderness, emotional wilderness, but the first 3 years were awful.
What happened,
and anger and resentment and all sorts of other things. But what essentially happened is that I had so many questions that I had never even occurred to me, including why is the sky blue, which is quite easy to find out.
Why is it blue again?
It's because of something called the Rayleigh scattering, discovered by John Strutt, Lord Rayleigh, who discovered also argon.
Oh, wow.
And it's because the atmosphere, the way the it scatters the different wavelengths of light in different proportions, so that when the light comes to us through the air, it blue wavelengths reach us more quickly, the short end of the spectrum. But actually, the truth is that violet is the end of the spectrum. The sky is actually violet, not blue.
We just can't see it.
Yes, our eyes are very good at adapting to violet. So you can find that sort of stuff out. But
before I took you on that tangent, you were saying, so the moment you realised that you thought artificial intelligence, all right, I'm not too worried about this.
Stop staring at suspicion with your Dyson Hoover.
I think one of the things to try to think about, you know, we think, will robots ever have artificial intelligence? They're already here. We are robots in many senses. You think that most people think they're acting out of logic and out of free will, and they're not. They're acting out of prejudice, out of received thinking. They're acting out of habit. That most people aren't free to do anything very much. We're just stuck in a loop. And one of the great possible potentials of being a human being is, are you just some sort of crocodile or ladybird that follows inherent patterns and do what all ladybirds done? You know, so you're born, you fuck a bit, and then you die. Or can you do something which is not just that, something more than that? Can you become indeed a truly conscious person? Can you be aware that it is not actually external events or the Germans or, you know, whoever it is you blame for whatever's happened, the EU, it's you. You are the thing that needs to be fixed.
Computers or the EU, one of the two.
You need to have, instead of what we have as a human being, artificial narrow intelligence, tie shoelaces, drive a car, and so on. Can you overcome yourself, which in Islam is jihad, the struggle to overcome the self? And that, as somebody once said, some great Islamic seer said, can you walk on water? You have done no better than a straw. Can you fly through the air? You've done no better than a blue bottle. Conquer yourself, and then you may become someone.
Beautiful.
Amazing. In preparation for today, I was doing some reading around the courses because we ask our guests what course they're going to bring, and was reading some of Yuval Noah Harari's book, Homo Deus, which talks about this exact issue. And there was something I wanted to read, which I thought was absolutely fascinating. And he said, maybe the life sciences view the problem from the wrong angle. They believe that life is all about data processing and that organisms are mechanic for making calculations and taking decisions. However, the analogy between organisms and algorithms might be misleading. In the 19th century, scientists decided brains and minds were much like steam engines. Why steam engines? Because that was the leading technology of the day. which powered trains, ships, factories. So humans tried to explain life. They assumed it must work according to those analogies. And then he says, this is very present in ideas like Freud. So he says, consider, for example, the following Freudian argument. Armies harness the sex drive to fuel military aggression. The army recruits young men just when their sexual drive is at its peak. The army's limits the soldiers' opportunities to actually have sex, releasing all that pressure which consequently accumulates inside of them. And it's all the language of a steam train, isn't it? So is it just the case that we don't really understand our bodies or what's going on here, but this is just the best metaphor that we've got at the time?
A computer.
Yes, I think that people, and the internet is a metaphor for all sorts of things. I think that's the technology tends to offer the metaphor for what everything else is about, but it's transient, as you say.
Yeah, but I mean, what Hariri is saying in that book, Homo Deus, what his conclusion is that it's not really AI that's the threat. It's cyborg. It's AI within human minds that's the real threat, because you're going to get a whole new species of human. There's going to be an evolution from Homo sapiens to something new, which is going to be a cyborg type human with Google in its head, and is going to be able to manipulate its genetics.
I mean, the thing is, one of the great mysteries of humanity is why, as far as we can tell, human nature has not changed one jot in the, depends when you think humanity began, 200,000 years ago, a million years ago. There is no evidence of humanity being any better or any wiser. Technology.
What, now? Come on, we went to the moon and stuff.
The technology, the person.
People
don't get on better with their families than they ever have. They don't commit less crimes. They don't have less unhappiness.
Oh,
it's worse.
There's less violence.
Especially in the West. Yeah, but in the West, but not self-violent. You know, something like two-thirds of all the gun deaths in America are suicide.
Right. Isn't Hayden's point more that, like, if people can see advantage to be taken, so, for instance, if you create a cybernetic leg for someone who's a victim of landmines, that's great. But then someone goes, oh, if I put that cybernetic leg on my leg, I'd run faster than everyone else. And then they start adapting these technologies to sort of basically make themselves better.
Well, you'll be more intelligent because you'll be able to Google everything in your head. You'll be, you know, you'll be able...
For what? To what end do you want to be more intelligent or
faster? Because you'll get the job that, you know, the subspecies who couldn't afford to do that won't get. It's basically what
he's saying. That's like that story about the... So a billionaire goes on holiday to a remote island in Malaysia.
Yeah.
And there's a bloke sitting there fishing.
Yeah.
And the guy says, you're good at this. You know, you should get a boat, because if you've got a boat, you could go and get lots of fish out there. There'd be bigger fish there. The guy said, well, why would I do that? He said, well, if you had one boat and you were good at it, you could hire another guy with another boat, and then you could soon have a fleet of boats. And the guy says, well, what do I want that for? He said, well, because obviously by that time you could start having a shipping line and you could become a billionaire and become incredibly rich. And they said, well, why would I do that? He said, well, then you could... have all that money, spend your time doing what you want.
Yeah.
And the guy says, what do you like doing? He says, well, fishing.
Back right by where he started.
Yeah.
But I think you're taking it from you're assuming that we would do it purely for self-interested purposes. I mean, look at the kind of state the world is in right now, where half of the world doesn't seem to believe that climate change is man-made, and yet the whole world is burning up. My uncle's one of them. He sends me emails every day. He's from Australia. Australia has forest fires every summer where the whole bloody country burns up, and he sends me emails saying, you see their climate change stuff, mate? It's a load of bollocks. I'm like, mate, you live in a country that is burning up because of climate change. So surely you could implant Google in my uncle's head and he would understand that climate change is actually happening, and people would elevate a little bit more and they'd be a bit more aware of what's happening around them.
Sort of reverse lobotomizing.
Yes.
So here's the thing about going back to parenting. Okay. This is the thing about my advice about marriage and parenting is that I think it's the first original thought I ever had in that context, which is it suddenly occurred to me, you cannot change another person. You can only change yourself, and that is your duty and your job on earth, is to try and be better than you are. I don't mean to be more goody-goody or virtuous or pious, but to be a better operated person.
I think if I had Google in my head, I'd be a better person.
Well, it's just
I just have the wickedest references at every social occasion. I'd just be able to, like, tell you who directed that film, this film, who wrote this book.
To what end?
Wow. Because I'd get loads of kudos and everyone would think I was super smart.
Listen, John Lloyd, you mustn't care what other people think. Further than us. We haven't even started the trying to think about Oscars and cool houses and stuff. We're just trying
to get the thing is,
who was it who said, somebody said, money doesn't make you happy, and somebody said, just give me the chance to find that out.
Yeah, exactly.
But I can say that. The least happy I've been was when I had more money than I could easily spend.
Wow.
Well, if you want to,
it doesn't make you unhappy either, but it doesn't sort out any unhappiness. That's not where it comes from. It's like, there are other ways to look for happiness.
So, John, tell us what's coming up for you, because obviously I'm listening to your fantastic Radio 4 wonderful show in the museum.
The Museum of Curiosity.
The Museum of Curiosity, which is really fun.
Well, the great thing about that is I don't have to do any prep, really. I just turn up and talk to people. Rather like this, it's not taxing. The producers are brilliant there. They're brilliant editors. Yeah. They make it sound a lot better than it was at the time, usually.
Well, looking at our producer, he's got a thumbs up. But any more? We've got lots of QI coming, I take it?
Yeah, another series of QI, and then we run out of contracts, so it's a question of renegotiating. After N, we're at the end of a two-year contract.
There you go, BBC. You got to make that negotiation, haven't you? You already lost the voice. Don't be bloody losing QI.
Yeah.
More no such things than news, I confidently expect. We haven't been told yet, but I think we will get that.
Well, listen, it only leaves it to us to just say thank you so much, John, for coming. You've been a fantastic dinner party guest, the sort of guest that literally makes you remember the things that are important in life, like seeing things the wrong way around, being a good parent, and nice, fine Italian desserts. Well, thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
And thanks
guys.
So much for being on the podcast.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.